Carlos was as accurate as it was possible to be. He said, "Alex, if you get 5 years out of him, you've struck gold. There's no precedent for a Portuguese player going to another country at 17 years old and staying 5 years. The fact that we had him for 6 was a bonus. In that period, we won a European Cup and 3 league titles with him. I consider that a pretty good return." When the possibility of him leaving edged towards being a probability, I reached a gentleman's agreement with him. I went to Carlos's house in Portugal to find the boy expressing an urge to go to Real Madrid and told him, "You can't go this year. Not after the way Calderon has approached this issue. I know you want to go to Real Madrid, but I'd rather shoot you than sell you to that guy now. If you perform, don't mess us about, and someone comes and offers us a world record fee, then we will let you go." I had already conveyed that message to his agent, Jorge Mendes. I did well to calm him down. I told him that the reason I was refusing to sell him that year was because of Calderon. I said, "If I do that, all my honour's gone, everything's gone, for me. And I don't care if you have to sit in the stands. I know it won't come to that. But I just have to tell you, I will not let you leave this year." I reported this conversation to David Gill, who passed it through to the Glazers. I'm sure it found its way back to Real Madrid as well. At that point, we were petrified that the details of our agreement might creep out. We warned Cristiano to that effect. I don't believe he would have told Real Madrid. His agent, Jorge Mendes, is, I should say, the best agent I deal with, without a doubt. He was responsible, looked after his players to an incredible extent, and was very fair with clubs. My feeling was that he was anxious about Cristiano going to Spain for the obvious reason that Real might just swallow him up. Different agents, different people. I think he feared losing him. What I always thought about Ronaldo was that even if he was having a dire game, he would always create 3 chances. Every game. Look at all the matches. In the mountain of video evidence, you could not find one instance where he failed to create at least 3 chances. He possessed an unbelievable talent. I can place everything on that list. Training performances, strength, courage, skill with either foot, heading ability. In the early days, there is no doubt that he acted a bit. His earliest lessons were in a theatrical footballing culture. Injustice was never far away from the judgments formed around him. But he changed. One aspect frequently ignored by his critics was the speed he moved at. You only need to tap a player going that fast, and there is a tendency for him to go over. Human balance isn't refined enough to protect the runner from tipping over at an unnaturally fast speed. A wee prod into the side of the leg or an elbow into the body can disturb the equilibrium. The failure to appreciate that speed-to-balance factor was unfair. In the early days, I accept, he showboated a lot, and Carlos worked hard on that part of his repertoire. He would say to Cristiano all the time, "You're only a great player when people outside the club start recognising you as such. It's not enough to be a great player to us at Manchester United. When you start delivering the passes, delivering the crosses, at the right time, people won't be able to read you. That's when the great players emerge." Opponents knew what to expect of him. They knew he was going to hold on to the ball. If you looked at his goal in the semi-final against Arsenal, you see the transition. We struck on the counter-attack. Ronaldo back-heeled it into Jisung Park, and we were up at the other end within 9 seconds. It took 9 seconds to put the ball in the back of the net. That was the transformation from the wee show-off who was desperate to convince everyone how good he was. Yes, that's really what it was. The need that so many gifted players have to prove just how blessed they are. And nobody could kick him out of that. No matter how many tackles or fouls he absorbed, his whole being expressed defiance. "You're not going to kick me out of this game. I'm Ronaldo." He had that wonderful courage and confidence in his ability. He elevated himself, in my mind, and in those of other United players, to a point where those around him were in awe of his talent. The players were good with him in training. They helped him learn. At first, when he was tackled at Carrington, he would let out a terrible scream. "Ah!" The players would give him pelters. He soon learned not to make that kind of racket. His intelligence helped. He was a very smart boy. Once he realised the players would not be a willing audience for his screaming and amateur dramatics in training, he stopped. Over time, it erased itself from his game. In his last season, he overreacted a couple of times to earn himself a foul, but no more than anyone else. He was granted a penalty kick against Bolton in 2008 that was never a penalty kick. Equally, he hadn't tried to earn that advantage. It was just a bad mistake by the referee. The defender stretched to win the ball, intercepted it cleanly, and Ronaldo went over. It was embarrassing, not from Ronaldo's point of view, but for Rob Stiles, the match official. Despite everyone saying they could have signed him, Real Madrid and Arsenal made that claim, we had an alliance with Sporting Lisbon, his first club in Portugal. We were sending coaches over there, and they were dispatching them in the opposite direction. When Carlos joined us in 2002, he told me, there's a young boy at Sporting, and we need to keep an eye on him. Which one? I asked. Because there were two or three. Ronaldo, he said. We knew all about him. At that stage, Cristiano had been playing centre-forward. Carlos said we would need to act because this boy was special. So we sent Jim Ryan to watch Sporting Lisbon train as part of our reciprocal deal. Jim returned and said, wow, I've seen a player. I think he's a winger. But he's been playing centre-forward in the youth team. I wouldn't be waiting too long. At 17, someone will gamble. So we threw the boy wonder's name into a conversation with Sporting. The response was that they wanted to keep him for 2 more years. I suggested a deal that would keep him at Sporting for that length of time before we took him to England. At this point, though, we had not spoken to the agent or the player. It was purely a club-to-club discussion. That summer, Carlos left to coach Real Madrid, and we went to America on tour. Peter Kenyon left, Juan Sebastian Verón left. Part of our arrangement was that we would play against Sporting Lisbon in their new stadium, which had been built for the 2004 European Championship. So over we went. John O'Shea was right back. People persist in saying Gary Neville was in that unenviable position. But it was John O'Shea. The first pass Ronaldo took prompted me to howl, for Christ's sake, John, get tight to him! John shrugged his shoulders. A look of pain and bewilderment was creeping across his face. The other players in the dugout were saying, bloody hell, boss, he's some player, him. I said, it's all right, I've got him sorted, as if the deal had been done 10 years ago. I told Albert, our kitman, get up to that director's box and get Kenyon down at half-time, I told Peter. We're not leaving this ground until we've got that boy signed. Is he that good? Kenyon asked. John O'Shea's ended up with migraine, I said. Get him signed! Kenyon spoke to the Lisbon people and asked their permission to speak to Cristiano. They warned us that Real Madrid had offered $8 million for him. Offer them 9, then, I said. Ronaldo was downstairs in a small room with his agent, where we told them how much we would love to sign him for Manchester United. In front of Jorge Mendes, I said, you won't play every week, I'm telling you that now, but you'll become a first-team player. There's no doubt in my mind about that. You're 17 years of age. It'll take time for you to adjust. We'll look after you. A private plane was hired for him, his mother, his sister, Jorge Mendes, and his lawyer to come over the next day. We needed to get that deal done. Speed of action was paramount. I used to scout myself on a Saturday morning in Glasgow, and I would always say to the men I employed in that capacity, it must be great when you can spot someone you know is going to be the business. One night, I was watching a movie, White Fang, the Jack London book about going down to Klondike in search of gold. That's what it must be like for a scout. You're standing watching a game on a Saturday morning, and you see a George Best, a Ryan Giggs or a Bobby Charlton. That's what I felt that day in Lisbon. A revelation. That was the biggest surge of excitement, of anticipation I experienced in football management. The next best was from Paul Gascoigne, for a different reason. Newcastle had been fighting relegation, and Gascoigne had been out injured. We were at St James's Park on the Easter Monday. I played Norman Whiteside and Remy Moses in the centre of the park. It was hardly a midfield of choir boys. You wouldn't dance round that duo. Well, Gascoigne nutmegged Moses right in front of where I was sitting in the dugout, and then patted him in the head. I flew out of the dugout shouting, get that so-and-so! Whiteside and Moses tried to impress on Gascoigne that he had just made a serious error of judgment. A little re-education was in order. But Gascoigne just skipped all round them. We tried our best to sign him that summer, but Newcastle sold him to Tottenham instead. When you have that experience of seeing this talent right before your eyes, you know you're experiencing one of those moments you search for every hour in management. And that sense of discovery rushed me into trying to tie up a deal for Gascoigne that very day. With Ronaldo, in contrast, Kenyon did manage to complete the deal. A sense that Sporting might have been happy not to have sold him to a Spanish club. The deal was concluded quite swiftly, with add-ons that took it up to about 12 million, with the sole condition that, should we ever sell him, Sporting would have the option of taking him back. A couple of days before we sold him to Real Madrid, we had to tell Sporting that they could have him back, but it would cost them 80 million. Not surprisingly, no cheque was forthcoming. As Cristiano started his new life in Cheshire, his mother and sister came with him. That was good. His mother was very protective, as you would expect, and was a good, straight-talking woman with no airs or graces. She was highly maternal. I explained to Ronaldo that Lynn and Barry Moorhouse would look after them with things for the house, bank accounts and so on. We got them some dwellings, tucked away near Alderley Edge, and they settled in quickly. We had returned from America after the Sporting Lisbon game, in a plane belonging to the Dallas Cowboys, who had rented it to us for the summer. Ferdinand, Giggs, Scholes and Neville enthused about Ronaldo all the way home. Get him signed! Get him signed! So Ronaldo came into the training ground, knowing that our players knew all about him, and had a sense of how good he was. I think that helped. His first appearance was against Bolton, at home, on the 16th of August 2003, where he started on the bench. The Bolton defenders ended up in knots. The right back rattled him straight away in the centre of the park, took the ball off him, but Cristiano got straight back up and demanded another pass. Right away. He's got the balls anyway, I thought. The next minute he was pulled down and won a penalty. Van Nistelrooy missed it. Then, of his own volition, Ronaldo moved out to the right-hand side and hit two superb crosses in. One was met by Scholes, who passed to Van Nistelrooy. His shot was parried by the keeper, and Giggs tapped in the ball for the second goal. The crowd on that side of the ground responded, as if a messiah had materialised right before their eyes. The Old Trafford crowd build up heroes quickly. They see someone who gets their rears off seats and take to them right away. Ronaldo had the biggest impact on Manchester United fans of any player since Eric Cantona. He could never have matched the idolatry that came with Cantona, because Eric had all this defiant charisma, but his talent was instantly apparent. The goal Ronaldo scored on the break in the Champions League semi-final at Arsenal in 2009 confirmed his majesty as a counter-attacker. The ball moved from Park to Rooney to Ronaldo with devastating speed. I always said to him, when you're going through on goal, lengthen your stride. By lengthening your stride, you slow yourself down and your timing is enhanced. When you're still sprinting, you have less coordination in your body. But when you slow your mechanics down, you give your brain a better chance. He did that. You watch him. In the spring before the 2004 FA Cup final in Cardiff, where we beat Millwall 3-0, Walter Smith, who had joined me as an assistant manager in March, asked me about the various talent levels of all our players. "What about Ronaldo?" he said. "Is he that good?" I told him, "Oh yes, unbelievable, even in the air. He's a magnificent header of the ball." Later, Walter said tentatively, "You keep telling me this Ronaldo's a magnificent header of the ball. I see him heading the ball in training, but never in a game." That Saturday against Birmingham, Ronaldo scored with a superb header. I turned to Walter. I know, he said. I had watched Millwall beat Sunderland in the semi-final and told my staff, "That Tim Cahill's not bad, you know. Good leap for a little lad. No great talent in the ball, but he was a constant nuisance, a pest. You could have bought him then for a million. He would have scored a lot of goals in a good team." Dennis Wise was especially combative in that match, but there have been plenty of nasty little players like him down the years. The sort who prompt you to think, "I wish to Christ I was still playing." There would be plenty who would have said that about Dennis Wise. He would never have survived in the old days. I'm certain of that. If you're cute enough in the modern game, you can get away with a kind of underhand physicality. Wise would be good at leaving his foot in, arriving a fraction late. He played his game well. In the modern game, it is hard to pick out genuinely thuggish players, those who step out to cause hurt. It hardly mattered, because Ronaldo destroyed Millwall that day. The one political drama we had with Ronaldo was, of course, the 2006 World Cup, when he winked at the Portugal bench after Wayne Rooney had stamped on Ricardo Carvalho. This raised the brief possibility that the two men would fall out to such an extent that they would never be able to play together again. What saved the day for Ronaldo was Rooney, who was terrific. On holiday, I texted Rooney and asked him to call me. He suggested the two of them, granting an interview together, to show there was no bad blood. The next day, I ran it past McPhelan, who thought it might look a bit prompted and artificial. I decided he was right. But the generosity of Rooney was what impressed Ronaldo, who thought it might be impossible for him to go back to Manchester. He felt he had burned his boats and that the press would kill him. Rooney called him a couple of times to reassure him. It wasn't the first time two United teammates had clashed in the international arena. I'll take you back to Scotland versus England in 1965, and Nobby Styles' first game for his country. Dennis Law is standing in the Scotland line, and Nobby shuffles over to him and says, "All the best, Dennis." Nobby idolised Dennis, who says, "F off, you English so-and-so, you." So Nobby is left there, stunned. Yes, Ronaldo did run to the referee to help get Rooney in trouble, which is common in the modern game. But Ronaldo was thinking only of one thing, winning that game for his country. He wasn't thinking about playing for Man United the following season. That was a World Cup game. And he did regret it. When we visited him, it was clear he understood the implications. The wink was misinterpreted. The manager had told him to stay out of trouble, so the wink was not to convey pleasure to the bench at his own role in Rooney's sending off. I believed him when he told me he was not saying, with that gesture, "I sorted him out. I got him sent off." We met at a villa in Portugal and had lunch. Jorge Mendes was present. Rooney calling him had helped to change Ronaldo's mind and put him at ease. I told Cristiano, "You are one of the bravest players to come to Manchester United, but walking away isn't courage." I quoted the Beckham situation in 1998. It was exactly the same as this. They were hanging effigies of him outside pubs in London. He was the devil incarnate, but he had the balls to fight it. Beckham's first game after that incident had been against West Ham, the worst possible place to go after such a drama with England, and he was terrific. "You've got to get through it," I told Ronaldo. The next game in London for Ronaldo was at Charlton on a Wednesday night. To begin with, I watched from the director's box, where there was a local guy screaming unbelievable abuse. "Yeah, Portuguese bastard," was one of the politer epithets. 5 minutes before half-time, Ronaldo received the ball, danced round about four players, and hit the underside of the bar with a shot. That guy didn't rise from his seat again. It deflated him. Perhaps he thought that his screaming had motivated him. Ronaldo was fine, had a good start to the season, and was getting on well with Rooney. These young lads will have their clashes. Rooney was going to be sent off anyway, but equally, Ronaldo's intervention was unhelpful. I was so relieved that the incident passed and we were able to keep him in the side that was to go on and win the 2008 Champions League final in Moscow. In the summer of 2012, I attended a Q&A hosted by the BBC's Dan Walker with Peter Schmeichel and Sam Allardyce. A guy asked, "Who's the better player, Ronaldo or Messi?" My reply was, "Well, Ronaldo's got a better physique than Messi. He's better in the air. He's got 2 feet, and he's quicker. Messi has something magical about him when the ball touches his feet. It's as if it's landed on a bed of feathers. His low sense of gravity is devastating." Schmeichel thought Ronaldo could play in a bad team while Messi could not. That was a fair point. But Messi would still produce great moments with the ball in his toes. Peter's point was that Messi depended on Xavi and Iniesta directing the ball to him. Ronaldo is much the same in the sense that you need to keep feeding him. In all the times I'm asked, I find it impossible to definitely say which is the better player, because to relegate either to second place would feel wrong. Almost as important to me as his brilliant displays in our colours was that we stayed close after he left for Madrid. Our bond survived our parting, a happy outcome, in a game of transitory relationships. 9. Keane. Roy Keane was a player of energy, of guts and blood, with a fine instinct for the game and its strategies. He was the most influential presence in the dressing room in the time we worked together. Roy took a lot of the onus off me in making sure the dressing room was operating at a high level of motivation. A manager could never be dismissive of that kind of help from a player. But by the time Roy left United in November 2005, our relationship had broken down. I have strong views about the sequence of events that led to him joining Celtic. But first, I should set out why he was such an immense driving force for our club. If Roy Keane thought you weren't pulling your weight, he would be right on top of you, straight away. Many players faced his wrath for committing that crime, and there would be no place to hide from him. I never felt that was a bad aspect of his character. In all my time, the strong personalities have helped shape the team's actions. Brian Robson, Steve Bruce, Eric Cantona. Those players enforced the will of the manager and the club. In my playing days, managers seldom interrogated players in the adrenaline-drenched moment straight after the match. The initial finger-pointing tended to come from the players, often in the bath. Or there would be confrontations while the water was still running. You missed that chance, you... As a player, I was always having a go at the goalkeepers and defenders for conceding goals, so I knew that if I missed a chance at the other end, I would be receiving it back with interest from those with the less glamorous jobs whom I had criticised on previous occasions. Those were the risks of being outspoken. These days, managers always have their say after the game. If they want to analyse, criticise or praise, there's an area of managerial involvement right after the final whistle where influence can be brought to bear. 10 to 15 minutes. With Roy, there were episodes of great friction and drama as he tried to impose his will on the team. On one occasion, as I came into the dressing room, Roy and Ruud van Nistelrooy were at it, hammer and tongs. They had to be pulled apart by the players. At least van Nistelrooy had the courage to stand up to Roy, because not everyone did. He was an intimidating, ferocious individual. His mode, when angry, was to attack, to lay into people. I believe, and Carlos Queiroz was at one with me on this, that Roy Keane's behaviour pattern changed when he realised he was no longer the Roy Keane of old. We're certain of that. Acting on a conviction that some of his strengths had been stolen from him by injury and age, we tried to change his job description, for his benefit, as much as ours. We tried to alter his role by discouraging him from charging all over the pitch and making forward runs. Every time a teammate received the ball, Roy would want it off him. That was an admirable quality. The religion at United was that when one of our players had the ball, we moved, and all the others supported the play. Roy was at an age where he shouldn't have been doing that, but he could not accept the new reality. I think he could see the truth of what we were saying to him, but to surrender to it was too threatening to his pride. He was a player constructed around his own passions. In the season prior to the fallout, he was beginning to show physical signs of weakness in terms of getting back to fulfil his defensive duties. He wasn't the same player. But how can you be, after hip operations and cruciate knee ligament operations and being on the front line of so many ferocious battles for so long? The energy Roy expended in games was quite exceptional, but when you enter your 30s, it's hard to comprehend where you're going wrong. You can't change the nature that has driven you to so much success. It became transparent to us that we were no longer dealing with the same Roy Keane. Our solution was to tell him to stay in that same area of central midfield. He could control the game from there. Deep down, I believe, he knew that better than anyone. But he simply could not bring himself to abandon his old talismanic role. That was a long-term context to the confrontation that ended with him leaving the club and joining Celtic. He thought he was Peter Pan. Nobody is. Ryan Giggs is the closest you might come to that mythical ageless figure, but Ryan has never had any serious injuries, Roy had some bad ones. His hip problem was the one that caused the biggest deterioration in his physical prowess. The first major fracture in our relationship appeared in pre-season before the 2005-2006 campaign on our trip to a training camp in Portugal. Carlos Queiroz went out to set it up because it had been his idea and led us to the most marvellous facility, Val de Lobo. It was out of this world. Training pitches, a gym and small houses, which were perfect for the players. I arrived there at the end of my summer holiday in France. All the staff and players were nicely ensconced in their villas, but bad news awaited me. Carlos was having a nightmare with Roy. I asked what the problem was. Carlos explained that Roy considered the houses at Val de Lobo to be beneath the required standard and was not willing to stay in his. According to Carlos, Roy had rejected the first house because one of the rooms lacked air conditioning. The second threw up a similar problem. The third, which I saw, was a fantastic house. Roy wouldn't take it. He wanted to stay in the next village, Quinta do Lago, with his family. That first night, we organised a barbecue in the patio of the hotel. It was beautifully presented. Roy approached me and said he needed to talk to me. "Roy, come on." "Not now, we'll talk in the morning," I said. After training, I pulled him to one side. "What's going on, Roy?" I started. "I've looked at the houses, they're fine." Roy erupted, issuing a long list of complaints, which included the air conditioning. Then he started on Carlos. Why were we doing the pre-season here, and so on? It was all criticism. It placed a strain on his relationship with us. He became quite reclusive, I thought, in that tour. I was disappointed. Carlos had worked his socks off to make the trip right for everyone. When the visit was over, I resolved to bring Roy to the office, to at least get him to say sorry to Carlos. He was having none of it. When we were embroiled in an argument once, Roy said to me, "You've changed." I replied, "Roy, I will have changed, because today is not yesterday. It's a different world we're in now. We have players from 20 different countries in here. You say I've changed. I hope I have. I would never have survived if I hadn't changed." He said, "You're not the same man." We had a real set too. A proper argument. I told him he was out of order. "You're the captain. You showed no responsibility to the other players. It's not as if we asked you to live in a hovel. They were nice houses, good places." The bad feeling didn't subside. The deterioration in our relationship really started there. Then came the MUTV interview episode, in which Roy let rip at some of the younger members of the squad for supposedly failing in their duties. We had a rota for MUTV interviews, and on this occasion it was Gary Neville's turn. On the Monday after we played Middlesbrough, I was not particularly interested when a press officer informed me that Roy was taking over the slot from Gary. It didn't strike me as significant. But apparently Roy had been giving the other players terrible stick about Saturday's game. Cut to 4 p.m. I receive a call at home.
"You'll need to see this."
In the interview, Roy described Kieran Richardson as a lazy defender. Doubted why people in Scotland rave about Darren Fletcher. And said of Rio Ferdinand, "Just because you're paid £120,000 a week and play well for 20 minutes against Tottenham, you think you're a superstar?" The press office had phoned David Gill right away. It was stopped, pending a decision from me on what we ought to do with the tape. "Okay, get the video to my office tomorrow morning and I'll have a look at it," I said. Jesus, it was unbelievable. He slaughtered everyone. Darren Fletcher got it, Alan Smith, Van der Sar. Roy was taking them all down. There was no game that week and I was due to go to Dubai to visit our soccer school. That morning Gary Neville called me from the players' dressing room and asked me to come in. Down I went, expecting Roy to have apologised. I took my seat. Gary promptly announced that the players were not happy with the training. I couldn't believe my ears. "You what?" I said. Roy had a major influence in the dressing room, and I believe he had used that influence to try and turn the situation. "Listen, Carlos Queiroz was a great coach, a great trainer. Yes, he could be repetitive with some exercises, but that's what makes footballers, force of habit. I let them have it. You pull me down here to complain about the training? Don't you start the pair of you. Who are you talking to?" And I walked out. Later, Roy came up to see me, and I told him, I know what's happened. Then I started in the video. What you did in that interview was a disgrace, a joke, criticising your teammates and wanting that to go out. Roy's suggestion was that we should show the video of the interview to the players and let them decide. I agreed, and the whole team came up to see it. David Gill was in the building, but declined my invitation to take a seat for the show. He thought it best to leave it to me, but Carlos and all the staff joined the audience. Roy asked the players whether they had anything to say about what they had just seen. Edwin van der Sar said yes. He told Roy he was out of line criticising his teammates, so Roy attacked Edwin. Who did he think he was? What did Edwin know about Manchester United? Van Nistelrooy, to his credit, piped up to support van der Sar, so Roy rounded on Ruud. Then he started on Carlos, but he saved the best for me. You brought your private life into the club with your argument with Magner, he said. At that point, players started walking out. Scholes, Van Nistelrooy, Fortune. The hardest part of Roy's body is his tongue. He has the most savage tongue you can imagine. He can debilitate the most confident person in the world in seconds with that tongue. What I noticed about him that day, as I was arguing with him, was that his eyes started to narrow, almost to wee black beads. It was frightening to watch. And I'm from Glasgow. After Roy had left, Carlos saw I was quite upset. Never in his life, he said, had he witnessed a scene of that nature. He called it the worst imaginable spectacle in the life of a professional football club. He needs to go, Carlos, I said. 100%, he said. Get rid of him. I was away until the following Wednesday, but phoned David Gill from Dubai and told him, we need to move Roy out. His response was that, from the accounts I had given him, there was no choice. He said he would need to speak to the Glazers, who approved the move. I agreed with David Gill that the club would pay Roy's contract up and honour his testimonial. No one could say we had treated Roy unjustly. When I returned from the Middle East, David instructed me that the Glazers were coming over on the Friday, and that he had phoned Michael Kennedy to say we wanted a meeting with him. We called Michael and Roy into the meeting and set out our decision, with all the details. Roy said publicly later that he was disappointed I didn't end his Manchester United career on my own. But after the original confrontation, I was finished with him. There was no way I wanted another war with him, or even to get involved with him again. I walked out onto the training pitch and told the players, and registered the shock on each face. I always felt that my best moments as a manager were when I made quick decisions based on irrefutable fact, on conviction. It was so clear to me what I had to do to stem this crisis. If I had prevaricated, it would have given Roy more strength in the dressing room, more confidence in his own mind that he had been right, more time to convince everyone he was correct in his behaviour. And he was not right. What he did was wrong. There was so much to look back on. So much to process as Roy Keane became an ex-Manchester United player. High in the list would be the 2002 World Cup and Roy flying home after a bust-up with Mick McCarthy, the Republic of Ireland manager. My brother Martin had taken me for a week's holiday for my 60th birthday. At dinner, I didn't take my phone along with me, but Martin had taken his, and as we left, it rang. It was Michael Kennedy saying he'd been trying to contact me. Michael made it clear that there had been an eruption in Saipan where the Republic of Ireland team had arrived to prepare for the World Cup.
You need to talk to him. You're the only man I listen to,
Michael said. I was baffled. I couldn't imagine what Michael could have been so distressed about. He told me the story of Roy's confrontation with Mick McCarthy. The number Michael gave me was no good, so I suggested Roy should ring me instead. Keane's voice came on the line. Roy, what on earth are you thinking about? Roy unspooled all his anger at McCarthy. I said, calm down. A bit of advice. You cannot afford to make your children go to school every day with this as the background to their lives. Think of your family. It will be horrendous. Forget the World Cup finals. This will be the biggest story all summer. He knew I was right. I told him to get back in there with McCarthy, just the two of them, sort it out and tell the manager he would be playing. Roy agreed. But by the time we went back, Mick had already given a press conference to explain what had been going on. There was no way back for Roy. I defended Roy to the hilt because he had come from Manchester United with the high standards we had. Going to a substandard training base with no training kit is a reasonable issue to get angry about. And as captain, he had every reason to complain. The question in life is, how far do you take a grievance? As bad as the conditions were in Korea, Roy shouldn't have pushed his anger to such levels. But that was Roy. He was a man of extremes. I always protected my players, and Roy was no exception. It was my job. For that reason, I can't apologise for the times I stuck up for them, when there were sound reasons to lurch the other way. There were times when I thought, Christ, what were you thinking about? Kathy posed that question to me many times, but I couldn't take sides against my players. I had to find solutions other than castigating them in public. Sometimes I had to fine or punish them, of course, but I could never let it out of the dressing room. I would have felt I had betrayed the one constant principle of my time as manager, to defend. No, not to defend, but to protect them from outside judgments. In modern football, celebrity status overrides the manager's power. In my day, you wouldn't whisper a word about your manager. You would fear certain death. In my later years, I would hear constantly about players using their power against managers, and the player receiving the support of the public and even the club. The player will always spill his resentments to whoever might care to listen, but the manager will not do that, because he has wider responsibilities. I think Roy realised he was coming to the end of his playing career and was starting to think he was the manager. He was assuming managerial responsibilities and, of course, it's not a managerial responsibility to go on Manchester United television and slaughter your teammates. By stopping it going out, we saved Roy from losing the respect of everyone in that dressing room. But once the meeting in my room developed such a venomous tone, that was the end of him. The one thing I could never allow was loss of control, because control was my only saviour. As with David Beckham, I knew the minute a football player started trying to run the club, we would all be finished. The real players like that. They like a manager who's tough, or can be tough. They like the manager to be a man. There's a reward. The player will be thinking, one, can he make us winners? Two, can he make me a better footballer? Three, is he loyal to us? These are vital considerations from the player's side. If the answer to all three is yes, they will tolerate murders. I had some terrible mood storms after games and was never proud of my outbursts. Some nights I would go home assailed by fear of the consequences. Maybe the players wouldn't be talking to me next time I entered the training ground. Perhaps they would be raging or conspiring against me. But on Mondays, they would be more terrified of me than I was of them, because they had seen me lose my temper and were not keen to see it happen again. Roy's an intelligent guy. I saw him reading some interesting books. He's a good conversationalist and good company when he's in the right mood. The physio would come in and ask, what sort of mood is Roy in today? Because that would determine the whole mood of the dressing room. That's how influential he was in our daily lives. With his contradictions and mood swings, he could be wonderful one minute and antagonistic the next. The switch would flick in a moment. In one deep sense, him leaving was the best thing that could have happened, because a lot of the players were intimidated by him in the dressing room, and those players emerged well from his departure. John O'Shea and Darren Fletcher were certainly beneficiaries. When we went to France to play Lille in Paris in November 2005, the players were booed on the pitch in the warm-up, partly as a consequence of what Roy had said in the MUTV interview. Fletcher and O'Shea took most of the heckling. I think the dressing room relaxed when Roy left. Relief swept the room. They no longer had to listen to the barrage that some of them had grown to expect. Because he'd been a declining force, the gap he left was not as big as it would have been 3 years previously. I watched him in a Celtic v Rangers game and said to Carlos beforehand, he'll be the star man today. Roy was never in the game. He played a passive role. The dynamic, fist-clenching, demanding Roy Keane wasn't there. He loved it at Celtic Park. I spoke to him about it, and he praised the training, the facilities, the pro zone. Things did settle down between us. About 2 months later, I was sitting in my office discussing team business with Carlos when a member of staff called to say that Roy was here to see me. I was startled. I just want to apologise to you for my behaviour, he said. That's when he began describing the scene at Celtic and telling me how well his work was going. But when I saw him in that Rangers-Celtic game, I knew he wouldn't carry on with it. Changes were already in motion before Roy left, but they weren't yet apparent. There is one abiding truth about Manchester United. We are always capable of producing new players, fresh names, and we had them on tap again as Roy was heading out. Fletcher was acquiring maturity and experience. I brought Ji-Sung Park to the club. Johnny Evans was breaking through. Often first-team players can't recognise the regeneration going on around them because they can't see beyond themselves. They have no clue what's going on further down the scale. Giggs, Scholes and Neville were exceptions, maybe Rio and Wes Brown. Others would have no idea. They see their job as playing, but I could see foundations developing. That wasn't a great period for us in terms of trophies. Yet, when you're managing change, you have to accept the quieter spells and acknowledge that transformations take longer than a year. I could never ask for 3 or 4 years to achieve change, because at Manchester United, you would never have that time. So you try to expedite it and be bold sometimes. Play young players, test them. I was never afraid of that. It was never just a duty, but a part of the job I loved. It's who I am. I did it at St Mirren and Aberdeen and Manchester United. So when we faced those periods, we always put our trust in younger players. In terms of recruitment targets, Carlos fancied Anderson strongly. In one day, David Gill travelled to Sporting Lisbon to sign Nani and then drove up the motorway to buy Anderson from Porto. They cost a bit of money, but it showed what we thought as a club about young talent. We had a good defensive nucleus of Ferdinand, Vidic and Evra. We were a solid unit at the back. Rooney was developing. We let Louis Saha go because he was always picking up injuries. We had Henrik Larsson for a while, and he was a revelation. After an initial rapprochement, relations with Roy soured again. I saw a remark he had made in the newspapers to the effect that he had washed Man United out of his life. His claim was that we would all have forgotten him by then. How could anyone forget what he did for the club? The press used to see him as a quasi-manager because of his winning appetite and the way he drove the team on. They would ask me all the time, "Do you think Roy Keane will be our manager?" As his career in coaching developed, it became apparent that he needed to spend money to achieve results. He was always looking to buy players. I didn't feel Roy had the patience to build a team. In the 2011-2012 season, we crossed swords again when Roy was highly critical of our young players after the defeat in Basel, which knocked us out of the Champions League, and I responded by referring to him as a TV critic. If he studied his final days at Sunderland and Ipswich, his beard would get whiter and his eyes blacker. Some might be impressed with his opinions on TV and think, "Well, he's got the balls to take on Alex Ferguson." From the minute he became a TV critic, I knew he would focus on United. As for blaming the young players, he wouldn't have aimed that accusation at Wayne Rooney. He wouldn't have stood for it. The senior players would sort him out. Fletcher and O'Shea are the two he picked on, and they were booed as a result by our fans when we played Lille in Paris. His two spells in management proved one thing. He needs money. He spent at Sunderland and failed. He spent a lot at Ipswich and came up short. He gave an interview to David Walsh of the Sunday Times saying, "I only looked after myself," and used the John Magna, Rock of Gibraltar situation as an example. Unbelievable. That day in my office, when we clashed, I saw the anger in him. His eyes blackened. He went on about John Magna that day as well. I never understood his obsession with the Rock of Gibraltar affair. In the arrangement we reached on that momentous Friday, it was agreed that no one would ever talk about our fallout. I would have honoured that agreement, but for the fact that Roy breached it first. When Roy was at Sunderland, he accused United of insulting him and lying to him in the build-up to his departure. The club considered legal action against him. Roy said he would not retract the accusation. My feeling was he was looking for a day in court to impress the fans. He was still a hero to them, after all. So my advice to David Gill was to pull the legal action. I feel we preserved our dignity. 10. Outside interests. The football-watching public probably saw me as an obsessive, who seldom looked beyond Manchester United for entertainment. But as the demands of the job intensified, I found refuge in numerous interests and hobbies that kept my mind stretched, my bookshelves packed, and my cellar stocked with good wines. Apart from my love of horse racing, this other life stayed hidden from view. It was the world I returned to when the day had run its course at Carrington, our training ground, or when the match had been played, commented upon and filed away. Over the final 10 years or so, I eased myself into a range of other interests that helped me manage United more effectively. I worked just as hard, but used the muscles of the mind in a more varied way. Home was a base for all my fascinations, from biographies of the dictators to documents on the John F. Kennedy assassination and files in my wine collection. My political convictions have remained largely unchanged from my time as a shop steward in the shipyards of Govan. People's opinions change over time with success and wealth, but in my youth I acquired not so much a range of ideological views as a way of seeing life, a set of values. I have never been active in the sense of becoming a Labour Party animal who attended every dinner and popped up in every election campaign, but I always supported local Labour MPs. Cathy would say that the minute you extend yourself into politics, they will want you every time. An expectation will develop that you're always ready and willing to give your time. Being a believer in the Labour Party and socialist principles is one thing, but becoming an active member was another. I just didn't have the time as Man United manager to accommodate those demands. I would put my cross on the ballot paper and support them in a visual way. You wouldn't see me sitting beside David Cameron, would you? You would see me alongside a Labour MP. That would be my impact. I've always been on the left of the party, which explains my high opinion of Gordon Brown's work. John Smith's too. The late John Smith would have been a fine Labour Prime Minister. I felt sorry for Neil Kinnock, a good guy with bad luck. I would have loved to see him in Downing Street. He had that fiery nature. I was closer to Brown in principle, but accept that Blair's more populist way was the route to get elected. He was correct in his positioning. Plus, he had charisma to go with it, and was popular for a long time until the invasion of Iraq undermined the public's view of him. My friendship with Alistair Campbell developed through that great man, veteran Scottish football reporter and confidant of several Labour Prime Ministers, Jim Rodger. He called and asked me to do a piece with Alistair, who was with the Mirror at the time. Alistair and I got on well, and he would send me wee letters and so on. He was a good networker. Then he became Tony's press secretary, and we became good friends through his role in the Labour Party. I had dinner with Alistair, Tony and Cherie in the Midland Hotel in Manchester the week before the 1997 election. I told Tony, if you can keep your government in one room and lock the door, you'll have no problems. The problem with government is that they all fly off on their own. They have their own allies, their own journalistic contacts. Controlling the cabinet is going to be the hard part. Tony was receptive to that message. In any position of power, there is fragility. If you're leading the country, there's a vast responsibility and a certain loneliness that I could relate to. I would sit in my office in the afternoon with my work complete, wanting company. There is a vacuum attached to the job that people don't want to break into. Tony was a young man going into that position. In his memoirs, he wrote that he had asked my opinion on sacking Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister and Gordon was next door in number 11. My recollection is that Tony wasn't specific about Gordon. His question was about superstars and how I dealt with them. My answer was, the most important thing in my job is control. The minute they threaten your control, you have to get rid of them. He did say he was having problems with Gordon, but didn't ask me specifically what I thought he should do. I kept my advice general because I didn't want to get into personality issues. I've always found that you have to take the hard road all the time, whether it's popular or not. If you have a worry about one of your staff, that tells you straight away there is a problem. It never made sense to me to go to bed every night worrying when you could do something to cut the problem away. Power is useful if you want to use it. but I don't think it resonates with footballers who are mostly working-class men. But control was my aim. I could use my power if I wished, and I did. But when you reach the station I attained at United, power came with it naturally. The big decisions you made in those jobs are usually seen by outsiders as exercises in power, when control is really what it's about. Labour politics and the great vineyards aside, America was the source of my main intellectual interests. JFK, the Civil War, Vince Lombardi and the great American ball games. These were among my escapes from the pressures of football. New York was my entry point to American culture. We bought an apartment there, which all the family used, and Manhattan became the ideal venue for short breaks when the international calendar took the players away from Carrington. The States always intrigued and inspired me. I fed off America's energy and vastness, its variety. My first trip there was in 1983, when Aberdeen won the European Cup Winners' Cup. I took the family to Florida for a routine kind of holiday. By then, though, America and its history had already entered my blood. The killing of John Kennedy in Dallas in 1963 left its mark on me from the day I heard the news. Over time, I developed a forensic interest in how he was killed, by whom and why. I remember the day that shook the world. It was a Friday night, and I was shaving in the mirror at the bathroom sink before going to the dancing with my mates. My dad, who was a bit deaf, called out, "Is that right that John Kennedy has been shot?" "Dad, you're deaf, you're imagining it," I called back, and dried myself off, thinking nothing of it. Half an hour later, the news flashed up. He'd been taken to Parkland's hospital. I always remember, at the dancing, at the Flamingo near Govan, hearing the song that went to number one, "Would You Like to Swing in a Star?" The atmosphere was muted. Instead of dancing, we sat upstairs and talked about the murder. For a young lad like me, Kennedy captured the imagination. He was a good-looking boy, and there was a certain spark about him. It resonated that someone as fresh and dynamic as him could become president. Though he stayed in my consciousness as a defining figure, my interest in the assassination developed along an unexpected route when I was invited to speak at a dinner in Stoke by Brian Cartmell. Stanley Matthews and Stan Mortensen were both present, along with Jimmy Arnfield, and I remember thinking, what am I doing here, with all these great players? Surely they prefer to listen to Stanley Matthews rather than me. But during the dinner, Brian asked me, what are your hobbies? I don't have time for hobbies, I said. I was obsessed with United. I have a snooker table in the house. I like a round of golf and I like watching movies at home. He pulled out a card. My son has a firm in London. He gets all the early releases. Any time you want a film, give him a call. The previous night I'd been to the pictures in Wilmslow to see JFK. Are you interested in that? Asked Brian. By then, I had assembled several books on the shooting. I was in the 15th car in the motorcade, Brian said. There we were, in the Potteries, and this guy was telling me he had been in the JFK motorcade. How? I was a Daily Express journalist. I emigrated to San Francisco and worked for Time magazine, he said. I applied to the Kennedy administration in 1958 to work on the election. Brian had been on the plane when Johnson was sworn in as president. That personal connection drew me deeper in. I started going to auctions. A lad from America, who had read about my interest in the subject, sent me the autopsy report. I kept a couple of photographs at the training ground. One I bought in an auction, and another was given to me. I also bought the Warren Commission report, signed by Gerald Ford, at auction. That cost me $3,000. When Kathy and I went back to the States in 1991 for our wedding anniversary, we travelled to Chicago, San Francisco, Hawaii, Las Vegas, and on to friends in Texas, with New York at the finish. We went most years after that. My book collecting gathered pace. The definitive biography of John Kennedy is probably Robert Dallek's An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. That's an exceptional book. Dallek had access to Kennedy's medical files and showed that he was a walking miracle with Addison's disease and liver problems. In the 3 years of his presidency, plenty of battles came his way, with a failed Bay of Pigs invasion, for which he took the blame, as well as segregation, the Cold War, Vietnam and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Medicare was another rumbling issue, as it is today. It was some workload. Here's an aside that casts light on the importance of the world's favourite game. Later in 1969, do you know how the CIA realised the Soviets were at work in Cuba? Football pitches. Aerial shots of football pitches laid out by Soviet workers. The Cubans didn't play football. Henry Kissinger was European in temperament and understood that. My reading on the Kennedys brought me into contact with some wonderful literature. David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest stands out. It concentrates on the reasons for going into Vietnam and the lies the Kennedy brothers were told. Even Robert McNamara, US Secretary of Defence and a friend of the family, was misleading them. He apologised in retirement to the Kennedy family. On our summer tour of America in 2010, I visited Gettysburg and went to lunch at Princeton University with James M. McPherson, the great Civil War historian who wrote Battle Cry of Freedom. I was also shown round the White House. My fascination with the Civil War started when somebody gave me a book about the generals in that conflict. Both sides had dozens. Teachers were made generals. Gordon Brown asked me one day what I was reading about. "The Civil War," I said. Gordon said he would send me some tapes. Soon, I was taking delivery of 35 recordings of lectures by Gary Gallagher, who went on to work with James McPherson on the role of the Navy in the war, a largely untold story. Then, along came horse racing, another great passion, another outlet. Martin Edwards, the former chairman, had called me one day to say, "You should take a day off." "I'm all right," I replied. But I was at the stage where Kathy was saying, "You're going to kill yourself." At home, after work, I would be on the phone until 9 o'clock at night and thinking about football every minute. I bought my first horse in 1996. On our 30th anniversary, we went to Cheltenham, where I first met that fantastic man, John Mulhern, the Irish trainer, for lunch. That night, I joined them in London for dinner. Inevitably, I found myself saying to Kathy in the aftermath, "Do you fancy buying a horse? I think it'll be a release for me." "Where did you get that one from?" she said. "Alex, the problem with you is that you'll want to buy every bloody horse." But it did open this release valve for me. Instead of stagnating in my office or burning time in endless telephone conversations, I could switch my thoughts to the turf. It was a welcome distraction from the grueling business of football, and that's why I threw myself into it, to enable me to escape the obsession with my job. Winning 2 Grade 1 races with What a Friend has been a highlight. The Lexus Chase and the Aintree Bowl. The day before the Aintree race, we had been beaten by Bayern Munich in the Champions League. One minute my head was on the floor, the next day I was winning a Grade 1 race at Liverpool. My first horse, Queensland Star, was named after a ship my dad worked on and helped to build. Trainers have told me of owners who've never had a winner. I've had 60 or 70, and I now have shares in around 30 horses. I'm very keen on the Highclere Syndicate. Harry Herbert, who runs it, is a great personality and a fine salesman. You know exactly what's happening with the horses, with information every day. Rock of Gibraltar was a wonderful horse. He became the first in the Northern Hemisphere to win 7 consecutive Group 1 races, beating Milreath's record. He ran in my colours under an agreement I had with the Coolmore Racing Operation in Ireland. My understanding was that I had a half share in the ownership of the horse. Theirs was that I would be entitled to half the prize money. But it was resolved. The matter was closed when we reached a settlement, agreeing that there had been a misunderstanding on both sides. Obviously, there was a potential clash between my racing interests and the ownership of the club, and when a man stood up at the AGM and insisted I resign, there was awkwardness for me. I have to say that at no point was I sidetracked from my duties as manager of Manchester United. I have an excellent family lawyer in Les Delgarno, and he managed the process on my behalf. It didn't affect my love of racing, and I'm on good terms now with John Magner, the leading figure at Coolmore. Racing taught me to switch off, along with reading books and buying wine. That side of my life developed really from 1997, when I hit that wall and realised I needed to do something else to divert my thoughts from football. Learning about wine also helped in that respect. I started buying with Frank Cohen, a big collector of contemporary art, and a neighbour of mine. When Frank went abroad for a while, I started buying on my own. I could never call myself an expert, but I'm not bad. I know the good years and the good wines. I can taste a wine.